From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Lawmakers remain gone from Tallahassee as festering resentments between some lawmakers and the governor simmer.
They have a personal agenda. They have vendettas or petty. It's not being driven by strong policy.
Also this week, a new president for Florida A&M University sparks controversy over transparency.
Showing the voters what we're doing. This is about transparency in government.
We'll also dig into what's been happening at this week's Florida Hurricane Conference and discover how the new law forcing some immigrant students to pay higher out-of-state tuition is impacting them. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Well, we start off this evening's Capitol Report in Tallahassee, of all places. Can you imagine it? And it was 2 weeks ago to the very day that we were anticipating that the Florida legislature would be drawing the 2025 session to a close. A hanky would drop on the fourth floor of the Capitol. Everyone would go home. The governor would sign some bills and veto others and, all, you know, regular kind of session stuff. And we're 2 weeks down the road and we still have not reached a conclusion. 2025 session still in limbo. Legislative leaders at odds over budget and taxes and those kinds of things. And it's all very confusing. So to try to pull some of those items together and give them clarity, we have politics and government reporter Tristan Wood to kind of bring us up to date on the state of all those negotiations. Tristan, hey, good to have you here. But what's going on?
The House met this week. They voted to extend the legislative session until June 30th via resolution. That's right up until the July 1st deadline the state legislature has to pass a balanced budget per the Florida Constitution. But the Senate didn't meet at all. And Senate President Ben Albritton issued a memo on Thursday saying that they won't meet until after Memorial Day weekend. So it's kind of these two legislative leaders jockeying for who calls the shots for when they're going to come in person to begin negotiations again before that deadline.
Okay, so what are the sticking points? Why can't these guys reach some kind of an accommodation here?
Well, the House and the Senate are currently billions of dollars apart on their overall budget asks. The House is lower in overall cost than the Senate, but as far as where those lines are isn't really publicly available. That's kind of the things that the leadership is talking, you know, behind the scenes. So we're not 100% certain on where every single one of these lines of sticking points is occurring and how strong one side or the other is on protecting those lines. However, taxes are the most public thing that the political players in this have been deliberating on and debating in public. House Speaker Daniel Perez wants a sales tax reduction by 0.75 cents, so a little bit under 1% reduction in the state sales tax. Governor Ron DeSantis doesn't like that idea and said that he would veto it earlier this week. But he also wants to eliminate property taxes in its entirety and push for ballot initiatives to go on the 2026 ballot to make that happen. Now, Senate President Albritton has been kind of riding the fence with that. He's been hesitant to pass a permanent sales tax reduction, and he's willing to explore those property tax reductions, but hasn't really committed to a full elimination of property taxes that the governor seems to be calling for. Those are kind of their main arguments and positions that they're at least talking about in public.
Okay. I would not impugn, I would not begin to imply that there are any egos at work here, Tristan, but these are all alpha guys. They really are the head of the House and the Senate and certainly Governor Ron DeSantis. And I would suspect that back behind the scenes and away from the cameras and microphones, there have been, you know, some pretty tough words being exchanged on these things.
No, absolutely. If you can just see how they're talking about each other in public. After the House voted to extend earlier this week, Perez told the press that budget negotiations stalled because Albritton pulled out of a framework they previously agreed on.
You know, it's for me, in my community of Miami, in my culture as a Cuban, You know, your word is your bond, and that means everything to us. I'm one of the old school guys. I can broker a deal off a handshake. You can take that to the bank. And you know, it's a sad day in the legislature when all of a sudden you're going backwards instead of going forwards on something that should have been coming to an end here shortly.
Perez also had strong words about DeSantis, saying he's unwilling to negotiate, compromise, or even come to the table.
The difference between the governor and the House is the House is always willing to have the tough conversation. We're always willing to answer the tough questions. We're always willing to have the debate. The governor isn't willing to have a conversation, period. Period. There's no difference between him and any seventh grader in Miami-Dade County right now who tweets.
Well, we know that Governor DeSantis is an easygoing guy, and I'm sure he just took all of that in stride, right?
Not really. He didn't take it too well. During other press availabilities he had, he says the budget is stalling over Perez's ego, essentially, and his political ambition.
And I think what you've seen in the legislature, you've got some of these folks in the House leadership, they have a personal agenda. They have vendettas or petty. It's not being driven by strong policy.
The House has also launched a special committee to come up with property tax reduction proposals, similar to the ballot initiatives that DeSantis wanted, but not necessarily an entire property tax removal. And they also invited the governor to come present his ideas to that special committee. The governor has declined that invitation.
No, I'm not going to go sit in front of a committee. That's not the role of the chief executive.
So this is just like the latest chapter in the deteriorating relationship between these two. It started when Perez and Albritton worked together to call their own special session back in January over immigration. And Perez has also butted heads with DeSantis on several other policy issues besides the budget, specifically allowing several committees to look into DeSantis' wife Casey's a Hope Florida charity scandal relating that's been covered to death by the press at this point, and also overriding some of DeSantis's vetoes that he did on budget items last year. So there really is a lot of bad blood between those two.
Yeah, and with all this contention and fire and fury flaming back and forth, Tristan, where do we go from here? You got any crystal ball or tea leaves we can untangle here?
Well, there's no clear alliances or agreement between these three yet. It seems Albritton may be aligning a little bit closer with DeSantis as of late. He appeared at the signing of this ag bill that got a lot of controversy, banning water fluoridation in the state, banning labeling alternative products with the words egg, meat, or milk. That controversial bill, Albritton was there and received a shout out from DeSantis at that press conference for the signing. Additionally, if Perez's account of Albritton backing out of his previous agreement on the budget is correct, that happened a couple days after DeSantis pledged publicly to veto Perez's sales tax reduction proposal. So if Albritton seems to at least have a better working relationship with DeSantis and what DeSantis is asking for. But again, a lot of these conversations and debates are happening behind closed doors. So exactly what's going on is unclear.
Okay, the average person may look at this as just a whole bunch of political mishmush, and it really doesn't impact anybody or anything. But what are the real stakes in this spat that's going on?
I mean, for everyday Floridians, it's a lot. If these three don't come to an agreement and the legislature doesn't pass a budget by July 1st, that could send the state towards a state government shutdown, which could cut access to services across the state, similar to the fear national government shutdown has in previous years during the federal government debates. Similar things like state park services, access to like healthcare resources, and other things like that could be put at risk. As far as the political implications behind the fallout for these political debates and public arguments are going to be, is it showing that there's clearly emerging factions in the state Republican Party. Florida Democrats are their weakest point since Republicans took control over two decades ago. They're basically pedestrians at this point. So it makes sense that what's happening here is these two factions are fighting for control of the state Republican Party ahead of the 2026 gubernatorial elections, where DeSantis is going to be termed out. With DeSantis weakened by being a lame duck and losing his presidential bid, It makes sense that Perez feels emboldened to dig his heels in now and not capitulate to what DeSantis is asking. But this conflict between these two can really lead to some challenges in Republican primary races for state seats, as well as could have implications in the gubernatorial race if Casey DeSantis, as some speculation has, does enter the race to run against Byron Donalds. Exactly how that culminates and impacts the 2026 elections, we're just going to have to wait and see.
And that's why we have to talk to you again real soon. Tristan Wood, thanks so much for keeping up on all this and bringing us the latest here on Capitol Report.
No problem, Tom.
Attorney Marva Johnson has been selected by the Florida A&M University Board of Trustees as FAMU's next president. The vote was 8-4 today in favor of Johnson, despite heavy pushback from community members. And as Margie Menzel reports, the decisions come amidst discussions surrounding the transparency in the search process for university presidents.
Johnson is the group vice president of a major internet and cable company. She has served on the State Board of Education and has ties to U.S. Senator Rick Scott and Governor Ron DeSantis. Community members have raised concerns about her politics and her lack of experience in education.
They have internal aspirations, and they feel that they can best be authenticated and validated by Republican acceptance and pats on their backs. Some people is just a lapdog and not a watchdog.
Leon County Commissioner Bill Proctor is also an instructor at FAMU. He's raised concerns about the lack of transparency in the search process, something caused by a 2022 law that allowed universities to keep the identities of presidential candidates secret until three finalists were selected. At the time, supporters felt the move would lead to better candidates because people could apply for the job without worrying about their bosses finding out. But this session, Pensacola Republican Representative Michelle Salzman sought to move the search back to the sunshine. Here she is on the House floor.
This is about showing the voters what we're doing. This is about transparency in government.
Salzman's move comes after complaints that it's become a trend under the DeSantis administration for politicians to get tapped to lead universities. A recent example is former Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez, who now leads Florida International University. Salzman says putting the searches back in the sunshine will clear up questions about why a particular leader was chosen and avoid speculation.
Media does one thing. People say one thing. People in back rooms whisper unanimous conversations, you know, off the record. And then it creates even more distrust in Floridians.
The effort to move university presidential searches back into the sunshine was a bipartisan effort, but one the governor fought against. DeSantis makes a point of pushing colleges and universities to the political right, and he was unhappy about Salzman's bill. They used to be allies, and she called him a great governor while debating the bill. But he said the measure doesn't reflect the conservative policy she ran on.
Because I'm confident if she ran on that, you wouldn't have elected her in the first place. And yet she is proposing a bill co-sponsored by the most flamboyantly left-wing Democrat in the entire Florida House of Representatives, is a co-sponsor. So do you think the far left is going to co-sponsor bills that are going to further our mission?
At a mid-April press conference in Pensacola, DeSantis said he's keeping a tight rein on Florida's institutions of higher learning.
Academia, left to its own devices, is absolutely going to run aground. They are going to go very hard left. They're going to be mired in all this indoctrination and all these ideological leftist fads. And we can't have that in Florida. So you got me in there. We make sure that we keep this thing going.
Salzman's bill passed the House overwhelmingly, but died in the Senate. In a statement to WFSU, Saltzman wrote that support for the bill shows that transparency is a value that transcends politics. I'm Margie Menzel.
Coming up on Capitol Report, Florida's annual hurricane conference takes a hit in the wake of federal funding and personnel cutbacks.
Anybody that deals with the aftermath or the planning for a hurricane is going to be involved here.
Meanwhile, should those under increasing risk from hurricanes be forced to relocate?
We want to keep people where they are and not have to face significant life safety risks.
And what does it mean for those Florida college students who suddenly find themselves having to pay out-of-state tuition rates?
I was shocked at first because, you know, I planned out my rest of my semesters already, so I was like, damn, they just won't allow me to continue my studies.
The start of hurricane season is about 2 weeks away. In preparation for it, thousands of emergency management leaders and workers flock to the annual Florida Governor's Hurricane Conference to get certifications and learn about the latest in meteorology advancements. But there's a noticeable difference at this year's conference: the lack of trainers from federal government. WGCU's Eileen Kelly is in Palm Beach County for the conference this week.
The state of hurricane evacuations, canceled. Hurricane readiness for coastal communities, canceled. Helping you help others, also canceled. The cancellation list is long, impacting more than one quarter of the hurricane conference's original 40 sessions. The canceled sessions are due to cutbacks in federal funding under the Donald Trump administration. Trump typically spends his weekends at his winter residence nearby on the island of Palm Beach. But frozen travel budgets for other federal workers means some two dozen workers with the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the National Hurricane Center, and the National Weather Service had to skip out of this year's events and training sessions. Sessions they were supposed to be leading. Will these 12 cancellations affect certifications? Event coordinator John Jamison with the Palm Beach County government said no.
A lot of these, the weather service trainings and things like that, are not required for emergency managers to get their certification to do emergency management.
Some 2,000 people registered for the week-long events. More than half of the states in the U.S. sent people to the conference in Florida. And Florida's represented quite well, with people from 53 of the 67 counties. There are also contingents of people from Caribbean nations, Canada, and even the United Kingdom.
There's an information aspect to it, so there'll be public information officers here. There's emergency managers here. There's a lot of fire rescue, police, anybody that deals with the aftermath or the planning for a hurricane is going to be involved here.
But it's not just hurricanes the attendees are training for. It's tornadoes, wildfires, and other natural disasters where masses need to be sheltered or evacuated. I'm Eileen Kelly in West Palm Beach.
Well, as Floridians prepare for another hurricane season, many residents of areas hit hard during the last season are still displaced. WUSF's Jessica Massaros reports on how some folks in the Tampa Bay area are redesigning their damaged homes to withstand flooding.
A couple of workers are tiling Michael Larkin's one-story home in Shore Acres, a neighborhood known for chronic flooding.
We're actually doing tile that looks like wood. So it's not real wood, but this way when it floods, we don't need to touch it. We'll still have to do with the drywall.
He had to rip out his hardwood floors after more than a foot of salt water flowed into his family's house during Hurricane Helene in September. From the ground up, 2 feet of drywall are missing across the entire home.
I feel like I'm on like a road trip.
For months, Larkin, his wife, and 2 adolescent kids have been bouncing from rental property to rental property, waiting out the permits and repairs.
I just can't wait to get home, and someday I will, but I can't go home yet.
Larkin is not alone. Across the region, those who are choosing to stay are rebuilding their homes with another flood in mind. About 50 miles north in Pasco County, Steve Papola's family is also displaced after Helene brought 4 feet of salt water into their one-story house.
That day when we came into the house and I saw the damage that was done and my wife was crying, I was like, I have to call, you know, my friend up and I have to say, is there any way I could rent your house?
They've been renting in Brooksville, waiting out the construction.
Well, everything we do is going to be considered what we should or shouldn't do because of flooding.
Papola is tiling the bedrooms and raising the electrical outlets. He'd also like to raise the house, but remodeling is cheaper while it's still on the ground. Much like Larkin's house in Pinellas, Papola's in Pasco is also missing drywall, but he had to remove 5 feet of it. Another 20 miles north in Hernando County, Charlotte Wright has no walls at all.
It was pure devastation.
After 5 feet of salt water inundated their home, Wright and her husband tore it down to rebuild at an elevation of 15 feet. Right now, it's an empty lot of dirt and grass on the Mud River near Wickiwatchee.
I'm here at least 3 times a week. I just miss it so much.
Wright and her husband are also staying at a friend's house in Brooksville. Like many across the region, they were forced to bring their home up to code in order to rebuild.
So a home properly up to code, what does it look like?
J.P. Murphy is the director of building construction services for Pasco County.
If more than 50% of the structure is damaged, you are required to either demolish and rebuild to current code and elevation or elevate that structure out of the flood risk area.
That's the federal rule for homes in flood zones, although the damage percentage varies slightly county to county. After last year's storms, Murphy says Pasco could end up changing its land development codes to make sure structures are more safe and resilient. He suspects the state will too, like it did after Hurricane Andrew.
Because we want to keep people where they are and not have to face significant life safety risks.
When property owners elevate their homes, he says it helps the county adapt its stormwater, sewer, and electric systems.
It's looking at community development in a way that is a sustainable model, understanding that we're facing these new risks. I think everyone will tell you that they've never seen anything like these two storms before.
Michael Larkin in Pinellas is planning to move after his kids graduate high school. Steve Papola is reconstructing his home with hopes to eventually sell it. But Charlotte Wright is committed to staying at her property on the water as long as she can.
The peace of living here is phenomenal. I mean, it's like nothing you'll ever experience unless you've lived here. Did you hear it? Something's jumping in the water.
About 100 feet off the bank, gently bobbing up and down, are a few manatees paying Wright a visit. I'm Jessica Mazaros in Wickiwatchee.
Florida's unemployment rate increased to 3.7% in April. That's the third time it's ticked up this year. The Florida Department of Commerce today released a report showing an estimated 410,000 people were out of work in April, out of a total labor force of 11.2 million. The rate was up 0.1% from last month. The number of people qualified as unemployed was 46,000 more than last April, while the state's labor force increased by 57,000 people over the year. Department of Commerce Chief Economist Jimmy Heckman calls the unemployment rate increase a steady trend.
What would worry me is something that's accelerating, but the fact that it's very stable, it's you know, still lower than the national rate, sub 4% unemployment rate at any pretty much any time is going to be a very good, going to signal a very good labor market.
The national unemployment rate in April was 4.2%. That was up from 3.9% a year earlier. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, being a college student without legal status comes with many financial barriers. For a decade, those students could pay the in-state tuition rate regardless of their immigration status, but that benefit is disappearing. WUSF's Nancy Guan reports on how a tuition hike could derail their plans.
In the hallway of Seminole State College in Orlando, Hernan stares at the photos of alumni hanging on the walls.
I personally don't know most of them.
We're not using Hernan's last name because he was brought to the U.S. as a child without documentation and fears being targeted for his immigration status.
They're pretty professional people. She graduated in 2018. Maybe one day I'll be here too.
Hernan is a junior studying construction management. He's worked in landscaping since he was 16, and he says a bachelor's degree will get him further in his career.
I will need this for higher, like, manager or even corporate positions, like up there. I feel that if I don't have this right now, I can't begin my life in that sense.
He needs to pass 9 more classes in order to graduate. But a new state law scheduled to go into effect later this year could delay Hernan's future. The law gets rid of a waiver that has allowed students who don't have legal status to pay the same in-state tuition rate as their U.S. citizen peers. They did have to prove that they attended a Florida high school for 3 consecutive years, then enroll in a public college or university within 2 years. When lawmakers created the waiver a decade ago, they believed it was fair to give young people like Hernan a chance at higher education. But attitudes have changed.
It is immoral to charge people who shouldn't even be in the country a vastly discounted price.
That was former State Senator Randy Fine speaking at a committee meeting in January. He and other lawmakers who supported eliminating the tuition benefit argue that it encourages illegal immigration. And now thousands of students are at risk of losing the waiver, according to the state's university and college systems. Holly Bullard is with the Florida Policy Institute. She says the new law stamps out one of the only means of financial assistance these students have.
Whether that be Pell Grants, federal financial aid, both of those these students do not qualify for. There are some private funders, but it is few and far between. And so in-state tuition has been really the path for higher education.
That's true for Jose Carrera, a junior studying biomedical sciences at the University of Central Florida. He's in the country without documentation. His plan was to go to grad school and become a physician's assistant, but he recently received an email from the university that makes his future a bit murky.
An evaluation of your record shows that you have not presented a documentation of lawful presence in the United States and are therefore no longer eligible for this waiver.
I was shocked at first because, you know, I planned out my rest of my semesters already, so I was like, damn, they just won't allow me to continue my studies.
Without the waiver, Carrera is looking at his tuition jumping from about $3,000 a semester to $12,000. The scholarship he's on won't be able to close that gap, and neither can he says. So he's thinking of transferring to another school that's more affordable.
It's kind of a sad feeling because you're leaving an environment that you're used to. You're leaving the friends that you've made, and you're also leaving professors that you have a connection with.
Hernan feels the same way, but he smiles and says he's staying positive.
We just gotta adapt. That's one of my favorite words, adapt. I gotta adapt to the changes, you know, in current society, you know.
He says he's thinking about applying for scholarships or loans that can cover the extra costs, or maybe taking a year off to work full-time and save up.
I consider this state my home, and it will be my home until the last stage, you know, where they kick me out or they deport me. But as far, I'm gonna keep fighting.
Fighting, he says, for whatever it takes to earn his degree. I'm Nancy Guan in Tampa.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Eileen Kelly, Jessica Massaros, and Nancy Guan. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week online and on air for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.